pretty much, my homelessness and couch surfing ended up starting when I was 22 years old. I pretty much was just hanging out with a friend, and I was staying at a friend's house, and then pretty much from there I just ended up moving in with them. And then, pretty much my AOD usage, so my alcohol and drug usage, more drugs was amplified. And then I ended up getting on some other drugs that wasn't the best decision. And, yeah, pretty much my life just went downhill from there.
Tell me about your life. What is life downhill like?
So pretty much downhill, what happened was I ended up going to my mum and dad's house one night. And I ended up using drugs at the house, and they found out about it. The next morning, they found out about it, and pretty much, my dad pretty much said, "You no longer live here," and slammed the door on my face, and that's when my couch surfing started.
And so how often would you be changing homes? How often were you moving?
So pretty much, this friend that I was living with, I was living there for a bit, but even though I had a roof over my head, it was very unstable. Because of the drugs we were both using, we were constantly in arguments, police were being called, I was getting move on notice. Sometimes my NDIS team would have to step in and get emergency ABN and stuff, so I just had someone to stay for that night. And pretty much it was a constant, I never knew when an argument would happen or pretty much when I was going to have move on or have a move on notice from the police. So it was very constant like that for 2 years, just a lot of move on notice and going to different places and then ending up in Airbnbs and then going back to that friend's house and then the argument would happen again.
And then the drugs and alcohol start. And so you're like in this vicious circle.
Yeah, it was a very toxic circle where, pretty much because, I lost my family and everything. So, I pretty much gave up on life and there was no point of living, to be honest. So I just kept on going in this vicious cycle and, it just amplified and amplified more.
And did you try to get help? Not want help?
At the time, I didn't want help, but I was very lucky. I did have my NDIS team, so I was getting daily support. So there was a period of time during the day where I was away from that and I could just decompress and stuff. But a lot of the time when I was seeing my support workers, I was on drugs. So a lot of the time it didn't last that long because I would just want to go back to that house to use more and everything. And it was like that for a good 6 months to a year.
And do you know what, Sully? And you're being so honest with what life was like for you at probably when your life hit rock bottom, and you're being very honest and open, and I do appreciate it because it's not easy to talk about your drug and alcohol use. And there might be some people going, well, you know what? Do you deserve help? Because you were taking drugs, you were taking alcohol. Just how do you... Because there will be people that will judge you, will be very quick to judge you. I just wonder how you respond to that.
Pretty much, I want to tell everyone right now that wants to judge people doing drugs that it's not their choice. A lot of people end up using drugs to forget the pain that they're going through, to forget experiences that have happened to them.
And so it's your choice, but you're saying you're doing it for a reason.
Yes, it's your choice, but you're doing it for a reason. And a lot of the time, that reason is because, you might have trauma, you might have severe trauma, you might have done some mistakes in your life that you're not happy with. So a lot of people, yes, it's their choice to do the drugs, but a lot of them are doing it to numb that pain that they're feeling. It could be guilt, it could be shame, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, a lot of people use drugs for a reason. And especially when you're experiencing youth homelessness or child homelessness, at the end of the day, you're going to end up using drugs because you're struggling. And a lot of the time it's a cry for help.
How did you get out of that life?
The way I ended up getting out of that life is that friend I was with, and it was also a partner at the time. We finally eventually ended up ending things, and I ended up going and seeing another friend, and that friend, things didn't go too well with that friend. And at that time, they had also had another friend, and I ended up moving in with someone in Fremantle in an apartment, and that wasn't any better. But eventually, I was there for 6 months, and then after that 6 months, I reached out to my NDIS team, and I said, look, I need help, and I'm ready to accept the help. And they got some houses through NDIS, and they gave me a house, and that's how my couch surfing ended.
I want to come to you, Amber, but just on that admission, finally, that you need help, is that a hard to do to say, okay, you know what, I do need help. This life can't go on.
Yes, it's a very hard thing to do, and a lot of people struggle to ask for help because it could be multiple reasons why they're scared to ask for help.
Ask for help and they didn't get the help that they needed. And a lot of people experiencing homelessness or couch surfing or whatever their situation is feel like they're not worth the help. So yes, it takes a lot of courage to ask for help.
A familiar story?
Absolutely. You know, this is Sully's story, but this is the story also of children and young people here in WA. I think without those accommodation options that have specialised staff with specialised skills that are able to wrap around therapeutic supports for these children and young people, I think of what Sully's life could have been if he had an option that was stable, safe accommodation, immediate accommodation with the right supports around him, what his life could have been.
Well, let's look at what you're after. Amber Lee is the voice you've just heard. She's from the Ending Child and Youth Homelessness Coalition and a very honest Sully talking about a couple of years where his life spiralled and probably hit rock bottom. And he's being so honest and open about it and how he managed to pull himself and finally ask for help to get out of homelessness. So in your pre-budget submission, you want the government to invest $150 million into this. How do you want that money spent?
Absolutely. So $150 million is the ask, and that is to prioritise the immediate, safe and secure, sustainable homes without those preconditions. We also are asking for direct access to crisis accommodation, youth FOIA, so extension of the youth FOIA model, which we already have here in the Leederville area through Anglicare WA, place-based youth service hubs, so that really integrated model where young people can come, they can get access to health, they can get access to look at their finances and many other things, including mental health supports. Safe space services, so those early intervention and prevention services that we're wanting, and then a youth zero project to really look deeply at what's happening across the state. We know we need to collect data, we know we want to be able to tell the story, and part of that is really elevating the voices of children and young through people through YHAC.
And how much social housing do we need a year?
We need at least 5,000 social housing a year, that commitment. And again, looking at that housing first model, which really looks like what do children and young people need, and let's design that together.
Pop your headphones on. I've got Michelle Jenkins on the line. She's the CEO of Youth Futures WA. Where are you based, Michelle, and what do you see where you are?
So we're both based in the northern suburbs, and we're seeing exactly the same as everyone else, really. You know, we're at crisis in relation to the number of beds that we have available and also the number of people that we're able to assist. We've got 41 crisis and transitional beds in the northern suburbs. But last year we had to turn away over 2,500 young people that we couldn't accommodate, and that's a horrific statistic to put out there.
And what happens to those people?
They have to go look for other services, or they end up couch surfing, or they end up living on the streets. There really aren't any other options that are available to them, unfortunately. And, you know, most of that is driven by the bottlenecks that we have across services, where we can't move people on in the way that we used to be able to, where somebody might stay in crisis accommodation for 6 to 8 weeks and then move into transitional for the next sort of 4 to 6 months, and then perhaps move into longer term accommodation after that, whether that's in their own place or whether that's in shared housing. And we don't have that trail of options available to us anymore. So what is happening is that these young people are presenting to us, with alcohol, drug, other issues, psychological issues, And there is an expectation that in a low barrier service, which is what we should be, that we will be able to manage that. And unfortunately, that management of that is keeping them in our services for much longer, but then they have nowhere to go post that.
Another snapshot there from Michelle Jenkins, the CEO of Youth Futures WA. And I know you're talking about Perth. I just wonder, we are broadcasting right across the state, and I imagine there would be pockets in regional WA that would be facing the same sort of issues.
Absolutely. We are looking at stage two of this project, and we'll absolutely be including looking at what's happening in the regions.
Oh, well, I'd like to touch base with